Welcome to the Solari Food Series audiocast. This is your host, Pete Kennedy. Today, it's great to have John Moody back on the audiocast. This time around, we're going to talk about homesteading, living a lifestyle of greater self-sufficiency. This past year has seen a decrease in the quality and reliability of the conventional food system, as well as significant price increases for much of our food supply. In addition, there's been a decline in the reliability of our medical system. Growing your own food and medicine is a solution to both developments. John lives and works on a 35-acre farm in Kentucky and has been homesteading for the past dozen years or so. He consults with homesteaders around the country and lectures and writes on the topic. Among the other books he's written has been the book, The Frugal Homesteader. He's a popular speaker at the Homesteading Mother Earth News conferences, and I can tell you that seeing is believing. Last time I saw him gave a talk, there were lines out the door. And I've also seen some of the pictures of the gargantuan produce he's grown on his farm as well. He'll be discussing homesteading in the countryside, but also in urban and suburban areas too. So without further ado, John, welcome to the Solari Food Series audiocast.
Hey, good morning, Pete.
Well, last time you were on, we started off by asking how you got into real food. This time around, we'll begin by asking what led you into homesteading?
Yeah, so I started the food buying club in Louisville, and I ran into a problem where I'd approach farmers and I'd ask how something was grown or how an animal was raised. And, you know, they generally tell me they did it in more conventional ways. You know, they used GM crops or they used chemicals or synthetic. And I'd say, hey, have you considered doing this in a different way? Have you considered you can raise food without all these chemicals? You can raise animals without all of these crazy. And they look at me like I was an alien. You know, just, you know, the thought that you could raise cows just on grass instead of giving them corn and soy and other things, or that you could raise fruit crops without constantly spraying them with chemicals to stop diseases and pests, they thought I was crazy. You know, because this was back in, you know, 2006, 2007, 2008. I'm in Kentucky. So Kentucky is generally kind of farther behind on the times. And so I was like, fine. I was like, you don't think you can do this? Well, I'm going to show you you can do it. Mm-hmm. So that was one of a number of motivations. You know, this was right during the, you know, housing collapse, and, right, you know, the Big Short and all of that madness and just all of that stupidity. So there was a mixture of, you know, economic concerns. Also just, I did not want my family and my children to grow up inside of a large major metro city, especially, you know, Louisville has had a 500% increase, I believe, in carjackings and a 300-400% increase in shootings over the past 18 months. And, you know, back in like 2010, when we moved out of the city, I'm telling people, you know, I'm like, hey, like, cities are convenient. Cities are fun. Yeah, it's nice to be 5 minutes from the cinema and 5 minutes from the mall. But cities have inherent instabilities that all it takes is the right set of factors to come into play. And you know, people thought me and some of my other friends were crazy for moving out of the city. And now everybody's trying to move out of these cities. You know, they're like, get us out of here. Like, what have we done? You know, so there's a lot of motivations. You know, being able to produce some of our own food, being able to teach others how to do it better, you know, letting my children grow up around greenery and animals instead of concrete and, you know, degeneracy and whatnot. There's a lot of things that got us onto some land.
Okay, so more and more people are looking to homestead these days, and you consult with quite a few of them. What are some of the recommendations you give to people wanting to start up?
Yeah, so the first thing is, this is something Joel Salatin said years and years ago, is if your goal is eventually to have, you know, like a homestead, have a more productive household, start now. Start exactly where you find yourself. So I was going to seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, living in an apartment building. And even though we were in an apartment building in the heart of a major metro city, I was doing worm compost in the basement of my apartment building and growing peppers and other vegetables in earth boxes outside. I got permission from the landlord to put up some earth boxes and other container gardening. And I started where I was. Because I meet people all the time who they think, oh, once I buy land, then I'll start doing and learning things. And it's almost always a disaster. You know, again, I think I might have said this last time, like Thomas Massey, even when he was at MIT, had a garden with his wife while they were students at MIT in Boston. And those are the type of people who succeed, because you learn to quit making excuses right from the get-go. You learn to see what you can do and what you have available rather than what you can't do. And so cultivating that right mindset and that innovative skill set before you even start homesteading goes a long way to ensuring future success.
Right. I know one of the pieces of advice you give people is to, little bit at a time, start with just a few things and progress from there. Could you expound on that a bit?
Yeah, so most people overestimate their abilities. Let's just, it's just kind of human nature. Most people think they can do successfully more than they can. So most people don't think gardening is that hard. You know, John, you just stick some seeds in the ground and stuff grows, right? You know, I've actually had people basically say that. So, I'll tell a story to illustrate this. About 6-7 years ago now, I got a phone call on a Friday night from a friend. And he called and he's like, man, he's like, I really, really need your help. And he goes on to tell me a story about how him and 3 or 4 other families from their church decided to do like a shared community garden. One of the families had a little piece of land out kind of, in the metro area, but out near the edge of the Louisville metro. And they were going to put in a shared community garden that they would all work together. And I was like, oh, like, you know, what size garden did you put in? Now these are people who at best had mostly successfully grown houseplants.
Mm-hmm.
So you say to yourself, what size garden did they put in? Maybe a 2,000 square foot garden? No. 4,000 square foot garden? No. 8,000 square foot garden? I think they put in like 15 or 20,000 square feet. It's hard for me to remember at this point.
Wow.
But like, that's as much growing space as I have. Like, that's my maximal growing space with years of experience. And they put in like bees, and they put in chickens, and they threw all of this money and all of this time. And, you know, but that was back in like April and May, when their kids don't have as many sports and activities and the weather's nice and cool and there are no bugs and there are no weeds. And he was calling me on a, you know, smoggy night in June, where one of the families is trying to rally the troops to reclaim the garden that is overran by like 3 months of weeds and overeaten by every raccoon, possum, and other animal in a 3 mile radius.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that all the time. It's like, you know, people want to have egg laying chickens. So they buy 50 baby chicks instead of buying 5 baby chicks. Another family I know, they had never had cows before. And so instead of buying like a pair of cows, they bought 6 bred cows that calved within like a month of them buying the cows. And so I just have like story after story of people who, I've never met a person who regrets starting small and setting themselves up for success and expanding. At the same time, I've almost never met a person who went big and didn't regret it later. And so you're never going to regret, you know, putting in a 500 square foot garden rather than a 1500 or 5000 square foot garden when you're first learning. You're never going to regret starting with a dozen chickens instead of 100 chickens. And you know, this is just like a good basic financial principle of minimizing risk exposure. You know, because it's like 100 chickens, once you've fed them for a few months, represents, you know, like $1,000 or more between time and feed and chickens and infrastructure. And so if you misbuilt your chicken coop and you walk out one day and all 100 chickens are dead, you're out over $1,000 now. Whereas if you only have a dozen chickens because you're still learning and something goes wrong, you're out $100. You know, so partly too, it's about, you know, minimizing your early losses. Cause I've met a lot of people, farmers and homesteaders, who take big, heavy losses early on and they never recover. You know, because they just set themselves up for such failure.
You know, one thing you emphasize, is the importance of having a mentor, just, learning from those who have gone before you. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, homesteading is a skill set or vocation. And if I wanted to learn, you know, how to do metal forging, like, yeah, could I learn a little bit off of YouTube? Sure, I could learn a little bit off of YouTube. But if I really wanted to learn that skill, I would go hang out with my neighbor who has a metal forge and work alongside him. And I would really learn in that environment and learn really quickly. And so a lot of people, I think, you know, books are useful. You know, online courses are useful. I've been involved in a bunch of both of those over the years. But they, especially when you're first starting out, they can't replace working with real live people. You know, so before we moved out to our land, I would usually 1 or 2 days a month go and work on people's farms around the area. You know, long before I ever had chickens, I was helping St. Asaph's Farm, which became Marksberry Farm Market. You know, I was going down to their farm and helping move chicken tractors and butcher chickens before I ever had a chicken of my own. You know, because you learn so many things in that hands-on environment where you actually get to interact with the animals, interact with the infrastructure. But you're doing it under the supervision of somebody who's been doing it for years often. So you can ask them questions and do a lot of other things that other mediums and formats just don't provide.
Yeah, which brings us to the topic of community. I mean, you've emphasized when someone is looking for land, it's not only just the land, it's who's in the neighborhood, just how, what kind of potential community there is there with the neighbors to help each other out. So, yeah, explain, yeah, your philosophy on that.
Yeah, so, oh, man, like, you know, having a homestead creates all sorts of daily commitments, you know, that are hard to walk away from. And everything you add to your homestead increases the complexity and thus increases how difficult it is to be able to walk away for a time. But I still want to be able to go on vacation. I still might have family members who die or who get married that require us to be away from the homestead for a time. There's, you know, there's just all of these things that can happen, and you need somebody who can come and actually take care of your homestead when you're not there. So just for very practical reasons, you need community, because you need people who can successfully, you know, we've had various people, you know, homestead farm sit for us over the years. And sometimes that's went well. And sometimes it's been just like, you know, every 15 minutes we're getting a phone call because the people really have no idea what they're doing. You know, and so like a pig's making a noise and they're not sure like if the pig is dying or if it's just being a pig. And we're just trying to have a couple days away, you know, so, but also like if you have kids, you know, in the city, your kids can hop on a bike and within 5 minutes have 500 possible playmates. That's not true in the countryside. And so when looking at land and other stuff, you know, we were actually in the process of moving before COVID hit last year. So we had buttoned everything up. We're about to list our property for sale. And you know, a lot of people are like, oh, what are your priorities, John, when looking at a new property? Is it the quality of the soil? Is it fencing? I'm actually, you know, like my biggest priorities are proximity to good churches, proximity to good other homesteading, homeschooling families, and proximity to a good judo jujitsu dojo that I can continue to train at. Because a lot of the other stuff, you can improve a house, you can improve soil, but you can't change your neighbors. You have very little control over the community around you. And so a lot of people prioritize the house and the land and the fencing and the outbuildings. And I'm not saying those aren't important things, but a lot of those things you can improve over time, but you can't change your neighbors.
Right. But I know one of the things you said you looked at was looking at a, you know, when looking for a land out in the country was just making sure there was, you were as far away from any commodity or industrial agriculture as possible.
Oh yeah. And that's, you know, one other thing that's something you can't control once you've actually moved is what your adjoining neighbors do with their land. And, you know, as you know, Pete, drift and overspray is, I'm trying to think of a good, you know, it's just an absolute endemic catastrophe every single spring. I forget what they said a couple years ago, but it's, you know, wasn't it like 6 or 7 million acres at least were hit by drift and overspray? It might have been a big, you know, so definitely if you're looking for land, you want a piece of property, even if it means it's a less nice piece of property. You do not want to be anywhere near conventional row crop agriculture because you will get hit by drift and overspray. There will be little or nothing you can do about it. You will suffer immense emotional and financial losses, and the system is completely stacked against you to both protect you and your property and to get any sort of compensation for the damage that is done. So steering clear of industrial agriculture is an absolute must.
Right. I remember the Legal Defense Fund had some cases in Texas, one in particular where, yeah, just the recovery was nowhere near the amount of actual damage. So these industrial ag people can throw lawyers at you all day and just take away your time and wind up where things just progress to the point where at one time there's a settlement you wouldn't have accepted at all, which looks pretty good after they've stalled you for a couple of years in court. But all right, well, let's go to planning and designing your homestead once you have the land picked out. What are some of the basic steps you take there?
Yeah, so one of the first pieces of advice I give people is don't build anything permanent for at least 3 or 4 years. And don't remove anything that's a permanent structure. So I was on Facebook yesterday and some guy bought a piece of homestead land and he put up a picture and it had a concrete pad with concrete walls, maybe 4, 5, 6 feet high. I don't remember exactly. And he was like, should I tear this down? And I'm like, no. I'm like, do you know how expensive concrete foundations and walls are? Like a block, a real solid concrete foundation and concrete walls, you know, right now that's like $40,000, $50,000 possibly.
Right.
Or something like that. Why would you ever tear it down? It could be one of a million things. And just because you don't know what it could be yet, don't destroy what it could possibly be because you can't see the future. You know, so I always tell people, you know, your first few years, don't make decisions that are hard to undo. And once you build a building, that's one of those hard to undo decisions. Moving buildings is, you know, bad. Bad for the building, bad for your bottom line. So, you know, focus on getting to know your land. If you need to and you want to fast track things, hire somebody to come do a consult and a design consult for you. You know, like people will hire somebody before they remodel their house. You know, most people aren't going to go in and remodel their own house, but they'll buy a 40-acre piece of land and they'll never think to hire somebody before building this here and putting that there and spending $25,000 improving the land. They never think maybe I should spend $1,000 to bring somebody in who's been doing this for decades to make sure I don't do anything dumb. So hire somebody to help you or take some time before you start doing things that are hard to undo. You know, so like raspberries, blackberries, other berry plants, those are easy to undo. You plant those, you decide in a couple years you need to move them. It's no big deal. You know, building a portable chicken coop or chicken tractors, that's easy to undo. Using portable fencing rather than starting to put in a whole bunch of permanent fencing, because fencing's super expensive and it's not really movable. Like, so other than perimeter fencing, you know, I sometimes meet people and I'll go to their property after they've been there a few years and there's all this fencing running everywhere. I'm like, well, we decided to put like a horse paddock there and then we put this there. And I'm like, but none of this fencing works. It doesn't work for you rotating animals. And now it's in your way and it's in the way of this, that. And you know, you put this fencing across where water is running. And now, so get to know your land or bring in people who know how to read land so that when you do build permanent things, they don't become a problem down the road. You know, like our property, where the barn is. So, and we didn't put this barn in. It was here when we bought the property. It sits at the bottom of our upper pasture, which basically means the barn seasonally floods. They put the barn right in the way of how all the water moves across the upper pasture of the farm to the middle and then the lower pasture. They you know, and now, you know, they would say in their defense, well, it was the flat spot. It was the one flat spot where we had space for a barn. Like, I understand that, but then you should have regraded the land around the barn to move the water from running through the barn to running around the barn. You should have put a pond right on the shoulder of the barn over to the side so you could divert all that water into a pond, and then you'd have a pond for the animals that had a barn instead of having a barn that seasonally is a pond.
Right.
When you buy land, get to know your land. Don't do things that are going to be hard to undo and that are going to be costly.
All right. Well, let's go to some of the day-to-day obstacles homesteaders and farmers face. Pests. What have you done regards to pest control on your land?
Yeah. So people are always amazed to hear that, like, last growing season, we didn't use even any organic chemicals in our food growing. So not even like diatomaceous earth and other stuff. And a lot of this goes back to learning to work with nature rather than against nature. Why do they have to fog our cities with mosquito and other sprays? You know, like up in Louisville, they always have to put out the warnings in the, you know, late spring or something. Like, well, we're going to be fogging these areas of the city because they're overran by mosquitoes and other bugs. Well, it's because they've unbalanced the ecology. They've right. unbalanced the ecosystem. You know, so like on our way up to Louisville, there's a train track that runs parallel to the road for a number of miles. And the train track is on a berm. And in between the train track and the road, there's this ditch. So there's this berm for the train track that goes up to the train track. It goes down into this gully. Then it comes back up to the road. Do you know what that fills with all spring long? Water. Do you know what multiplies all spring long in that water? Mosquitoes. And then that part of the city is overran by mosquitoes and other bugs. You know, it's a design problem. So one of the first things you do on your property is you want to design ecosystems that reduce pest pressure and increase predatory species pressure. In woodlands, one reason ticks are such a problem is because we no longer have pigs and other animals moving through the woodlands, keeping them cleaner. So we've increased the habitat for ticks, and then people don't keep as many chickens and guinea hens and other animals, so we've decreased the predators of ticks.
Right.
And so you kind of see how we create our own problems. We put in ponds everywhere, but very few people keep ducks anymore. The first rule is just like good design. Reducing, you know, habitat that really encourages pest species, increasing habitat and features, or bringing on more predatory species. goes a long, long way in reducing certain pests.
I know one thing you've done has been putting bat houses up along your property. Could you talk about that and just the effect it's had?
Well, we haven't got to put them here yet, but we have bats on our property. I've meant
okay.
to build
bat Okay, houses. I thought you did. All right.
We put up a lot of bird houses.
Right.
And we've done other things, and bat houses are on our list, especially because we already have at least one bat colony that's very close to our land. I'd have to look up the number, but like a single bat or single bat colony eats thousands of insects a day. It makes those little zapping lights look like child's play in terms right. of pest control. But bat houses, there's a great story out of Texas. I think it was from the late 1800s, whereas when they were having malaria issues, and there was a mayor or somebody down there who, instead of like trying chemicals or other things to deal with the mosquitoes that were spreading malaria, he built giant bat houses all across, this region of Texas. And so they became like the first malaria-free area by working, by working with nature rather than working against nature. So bird houses, bat houses, people are always amazed that roughly 20 to 30% of our growing spaces are dedicated to flowers and other perennial plants. Because they're like, you're giving up a third of all your growing space. I'm like, yeah, but this allows me to grow twice as much more in the remaining space because my pollination is so much better and my pest pressure is so much lower. There was a great study done out of England a few years ago where I think they just gave up 10% of row crop space in row crop operations and planted, every 10th row or something to native wildflower mix. And that simple 10%, putting back to a more natural habitat slashed the need for pesticides, I think by up to 80% for these farms. It was just incredible. We grow tons and tons of flowers, both perennial flowers and annual flowers. We do a lot of cover cropping and other things that provide the habitat that beneficial creatures need to do the work for, because one of my homesteading principles is I never want to do something that an animal or nature or a microbe or a plant will do for me. So people are like, John, why don't you till? I was like, well, why would I till when I can have a plant till for me? They're like, plants till?
Right.
I didn't know plants could run a tiller. It's like, what do you think plant roots are? Plant roots are the original tillage machine. They put, so grow the right plants, they till and break up the soil for you. Have the right animals, they take care of the pests for you.
Right. Which brings up some of these other critters like deer, squirrels, raccoons. There's nothing more demoralizing than having a squirrel having this beautiful mango or avocado, having a squirrel taking one bite out of it and just leaving it there. How have you dealt with the critters on your farm?
Yeah, so a dog is probably one of the best investments if you get the right breed and the right dog, because it will keep a lot of things off of a couple acre area. So it'll protect some of your livestock. It can protect your trees and things from deer. It can protect your garden. So dogs can be super effective. Fencing is somewhat effective, especially if it's done right. The problem with fencing is animals can go under it and animals can go over it.
Right.
And so people who rely on fencing alone often run into significant problems. So we use a mixture of, targeted hunting when hunting is necessary to cut back numbers. I became somewhat adept at trapping certain types of predatory, problematic species. We do double fencing around our main garden, and getting a dog has been on my list for a while. If I can find a breed that'll work well kind of with our size operation and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go on to another obstacle, and that would be weeds. I mean, you touched on this earlier when you spoke about cover cropping, but if you could elaborate more, please.
Yeah, so I wrote an entire book about dealing with weeds. And so there's like so much we could say here. The way most people garden is the proverbial hamster wheel. And I tried this when we first bought our land. The first thing I did was try and borrow a tiller from somebody. Well, why do you need a tiller? Because that's how you get rid of the grass and weeds, isn't it? But it's wrong, because for every weed or plant you kill with a tiller, you turn up 1,000 of its progeny that it has dropped into the soil over all the years it has sat there. And you end up on this hamster wheel, that it's almost like the pharmaceutical industry, where you take one drug and that drug creates these side effects. So then you take a second drug for the side effects of the first drug, but that one also has, so now you're on a third drug for the side effects from the second drug, and that one, and you're just trapped. You're just going round and round in circles. And so I wanted to get off of that hamster wheel. And so I used methods like, occulation, which is tarping with dark tarps, solarization, which is using clear plastic, cover cropping, just all of these different tactics that, and also though, I've also learned that a lot of things we think are weeds are actually incredibly nutritious things for either us or our animals.
Right.
We're recording this, April 16th. Most of the country, do you know what's growing all over disturbed soil right now? Chickweed and henbit. Why do you think chickweed is called chickweed? Because chickens love that weed. Why do you think henbit is called henbit? Because, right. So when, over the past 4 weeks, yes, we've had to weed the garden of some early season weeds that are coming up, but we're weeding it by feeding it to our chickens, who are literally eating 20 gallons a day of weeds. So they need very little feed, because they're getting all of this really, really new, because people always ask me, like, how can you raise chickens without soy? How can you raise chickens without having to buy, all of this expensive feed?
Right.
Well, part of it is, seeing the relationship between the parts of your homestead. And so a lot of weeding, lamb's quarter, chickweed, henbit, purple dead nettle, a lot of these weeds that come in our area, dock and stuff. We feed those to our pigs. We feed those to our chickens. It makes our pigs and chickens more nutritious. It reduces the amount of bought feed we need for them. And that redeems the time it takes for us to cut out those weeds in the garden patches. And everybody wins.
Right. When you talk about cover cropping, I mean, I've heard you use the phrase just a jungle of plants. So you don't want to, yeah, you don't want, you want to expose as little as you can, I guess, to sunlight, leave as little open space as you can in the garden, correct?
Yeah, you know, so people who generally see our homestead in June or July, or like our high tunnel, one of their first comments always is, they're like, this looks like a jungle. Because, you know, think about the way you think about most gardens. You'll have a row of pepper plants or a row of tomato plants. And what is around each tomato or pepper plant? It's a moonscape. Like a lot of people's, you know, when I see how most people grow stuff, it's this giant cratered moonscape of nothingness. They till up the ground, destroying the soil, destroying the health of the soil. Then they plant a lone tomato plant. And then a foot away, they plant another tomato plant.
Right.
And their whole goal for the next 4 months is to protect that tomato plant at whatever cost. So then they go back through and they cultivate or they till. And it's, but you look at nature, plants grow in partnership and harmony with other plants. Healthy plants actually require the very, very close presence of other plants. You know, I don't know how deep we want to get in this today, but like, you know, when you eat food, what actually lets your body access the nutrients in that food? It's your microbiome. It's right. The fungi and yeast and bacteria and other things that live inside of you. This is the same for soil. This is amazing. Like I was outside this morning just like singing hymns because I was like, this is so amazing. What is the one thing plants can do that pretty much nothing else in the world can do? They can take photons that the sun is shooting at us and they can turn them into sugar. That's like what makes plants amazing. All of that energy that the sun bathes the planet in, a plant can turn into sugar. And the plant uses some of that sugar to grow, but it sends a lot of it down to the tips of its roots in the soil.
Right.
And then it trades the sugar. Who does it trade the sugar with? The soil microbiome. The healthier your soil's microbiome, the healthier basically your soil's stock exchange. The healthier your plants, the more nutritious your food, the better your yields. And so the more roots and stuff you have, the better everything works.
Let's get into that more. I mean, that's probably your specialty more than anything is just soil, that producing healthy soils. Yeah, if you could talk about what you look for, what factors you need to have the healthy soils. I guess your use of mulch, compost, and producing that.
Yeah, so healthy soil, what, you know, if you were to say to me, John, I'm putting in a garden, or John, I've been gardening a few years, but I want to improve what I'm doing, where do I start? Step one is a soil test. They cost anywhere from $0 to $15 to have your soil tested. It's literally dirt cheap to get a soil test. And you absolutely want to do soil testing. Because with, you know, my motto is without a test, it's just a guess. And so I see people like, well, should I use animal manure, John? Should I put down super popular right now. It's, you know, kelp, you know, sea mineral on my soil. Should I put down azomite, John? Should I put down calcium, John? I don't know. Do you have a soil test? Like, how can you know without a soil test what your soil actually needs? It was hilarious. You know, this is just another social media warning story. I think it was 2 years ago, somebody in a major farming group on social media put up a post. And this guy puts up a post and he says, what would you apply to this piece of ground to grow, you know, peppers and tomatoes? The first like 10 people who chime into the post all say, what are your soil tests say? The guy goes back to the original post and he edits it. And he says, I am not going to bother to do a soil test. So knowing that, tell me what I should do to the ground. And man, Pete, the people just shredded him in the comments.
Right.
I mean, it was like 5,000 comments of hilarity. You know, so it's like somebody saying, you know, what gas should I put in my car? I don't have a gas gauge. I don't know the model of the car. I don't know if it's diesel even or not. But what gas should I put into this thing?
Just, you flying know, blind.
Yeah. So start with a soil test. It's cheap. It gives you all sorts of good basic information. And it'll tell you things like where is your organic matter and some other stuff. And then, again, this is where like it's such a cheap thing. You could usually find a soil consultant type person for $50 to $100 if you don't know what to do with the results to help you devise a game plan so you know what to do with the results.
And it's easy to find a lab, right? It's pretty easy to find a lab to do the testing.
Yeah, well, you know, like you can use an independent lab, but what most people use is pretty much in every single county in all of America, there's a USDA extension office.
Right.
And all of those do soil testing. And it's usually you've already paid for it via your taxes. So it's anywhere from $0 to like $5 to $10 usually, because you've already paid for it. And so, you know, you can do an independent lab if you want, or you can just do one of the extension services. And you take in your little baggie of soil, and they then send it to, you know, your state lab. And in anywhere from like 3 to 4 weeks, you'll get a letter in the mail back with your results. And then usually a recommendation section that is utterly worthless. Right. And that 95% of the time you should ignore.
Yeah.
You know,
these tests or the minerals they discuss in the test, is that pretty standard?
You're going to get your pH.
Right.
You're going to get a base set of minerals, calcium, phosphorus, potassium, iron, sometimes boron. I'd have to go grab one of mine to see what UK does. And you'll usually get your, you know, CEC, the caution exchange number,
right?
Which we're not going to get into something like that today. It's a little more complicated. And then I suggest at least every other year, it's usually like $5 extra. You get your organic matter levels tested. Because at the end of the day, if love covers a multitude of sins, and if trim covers a multitude of carpentry sins, organic matter is what covers soil sins. Organic matter is really the heart and soul of healthy soil. And so you want to be managing your soil in a way that your organic matter levels, if they're already good, stay that way or increase. And if they're low, you're building soil organic matter, because nutrient-dense food and healthy plants and drought resistance and so much else all hinges on soil organic matter.
Which brings up, if you could talk about your own experience, describe the land the way it was when you bought it and what you did to the organic matter, I guess, within a fairly short period of time.
You know, so I joke, but it is absolutely true. I managed to buy a farm, soil not included. And I borrowed a neighbor's tiller, and the tiller broke before the soil did. We had less than 0.5% organic matter, rock hard clay on top of limestone floaters. I grew in cardboard boxes our first year because I could not grow anything in the ground. Nothing could grow in that soil except for weeds and grass. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I basically used a mixture of approaches. At first, I got entire, triaxial loads of, cow compost from our local stockyards. And we had our own chickens and stuff, so we started making compost. And I would get all of the wood chips I could possibly get from the local tree trimmers. This reminds me, I need to call them when I get off this podcast today to try and get more wood chips. And so I began at first, you know, especially if you're dealing with really bad soil, you're going to import at first nutrients and I picked up for years 1,000 or more pounds of coffee grounds a week from small coffee shops up in Louisville, because coffee grounds are like 50% organic matter, almost just incredible. Right now in America, a city like Louisville, a small coffee shop produces almost 5 gallons a day of coffee grounds. And Louisville has 1,000 small coffee shops.
Right.
That's 5,000 gallons a day times 400 days a year almost. Is that 20 million? How many zeros do you end up with there? 20 million. Yeah, it's an insane amount, and that's just the small coffee shops. That's not the United States produces enough coffee grounds alone. There's an article on NPR just a week or two ago, mm-hmm. where they said that at least 1/3 of arable farmable land in America is now completely degraded. Completely. 1/3 of farmable land is now completely degraded.
Yep.
We produce enough coffee ground, enough coffee grounds alone in America to rebuild probably like 1 million acres a year in terms of organic matter and some of the soil health. It's crazy. So we grabbed coffee grounds and other things. But the thing you have to realize with soil is soil is like the Dead Sea. Why is the Dead Sea dead?
No matter.
Well, stuff flows in, but it never leaves.
Right.
And so one of the most common mistakes I see among people managing their soil is they end up a whole lot like the Dead Sea, where they're constantly importing more and more cow manure, more and more material and compost, but they're not cycling it back out. And your soil can become the Dead Sea. I had a soil consulting client years ago. She's like, nothing will grow in this section of my backyard. I was like, well, have you done a soil test? She says, well, no. It's like, well, get a soil test and we can talk. And she sends me the soil test. And Pete, I don't think the moon was as high in minerals as this woman's backyard. I think if I scooped up dirt off the surface of the moon it would test lower than this poor lady's backyard. And I had to ask her, I was like, what on earth happened here? She's like, well, years and years ago, they said the pH of the soil was really high. And so they wanted to lower the pH or whatever. So they put down all of these amendments. I'm like, they put down amendments without testing the soil first. Mm-hmm. And the soil's pH was really, really high because it already had all of these minerals and stuff in it. And now they're dousing it. And now the soil's just a moonscape. And her only option is to bulldoze it out because it's too high to fix.
Wow.
Yeah, and this is why cover cropping is so important, where you begin to cycle these nutrients you're bringing in, and you begin to become less reliant on massive imports of nutrients because you're starting to grow them yourself.
Right.
And you're starting to hold them in place and make them available to the plants. And so over time, the way you manage your soil should become far more targeted. You know, so like at this point, we've been here a decade. I pretty much never put down compost anymore. I'm putting down targeted minerals and other amendments that I know are exactly what I need at this point. Because I already have a lot of phosphorus. I already have a lot of potassium. I already have other things. So I'm only applying what I... So once you get healthy soil, you move to only applying to what you need. Mm-hmm. So that you manage it well rather than beginning to unbalance kind of that beautiful dance and equation.
Well, you mentioned earlier just using manure, but... Just one of the things you've also brought up is growing your own fertilizer, basically, because the manure doesn't fix nitrogen in the soil like you need. So, yeah, if you could discuss that.
Yeah, so a lot of people who grow food are really heavily dependent on animal manure for fertility. And the problem with animal manure is it has far too much phosphorus and potassium for far too little nitrogen.
Right.
So yes, manure provides nitrogen, but for the amount of phosphorus and potassium it usually has, it doesn't have that much nitrogen. And so over time, you end up building up excess phosphorus and potassium in your growing spaces, but you're always running short on nitrogen. And you create this, whereas it's amazing. Like, I think the atmosphere around us, I believe it's 70% nitrogen. I believe nitrogen might be the most.
It's like 78%.
Yeah. So it's the most abundant gas in the atmosphere. There's a problem. Plants can do nothing with the nitrogen in the atmosphere. It's in a form that's completely unavailable to plants. But there is an entire, you know, there's tons of, and there's even trees that do this. So this is like Mark Shepard, who's really awesome permaculture guy.
Right.
You know, he points out you can even plant trees that will fix nitrogen for your other trees. But there are all sorts of plants that have one other superpower beyond just turning, you know, photons from the sun into sugar. They can take atmospheric nitrogen and through bacteria that colonize their root systems, they can turn it into soil nitrogen that is available to them and other plants. And clovers and beans and legumes, you know, there's just a whole bunch of different plants that can do this.
Right. Yeah, that's what soy was originally for before it became way too big a part of the standard American diet. But I know one last topic on the soils. One of the things you've had a lot of success with in improving your soil is worm composting. So good, you get into the use of worms and yeah, just the difference it's made.
Yeah. So I got into worm compost before we even had a farm, because it's something I could do in the basement of my apartment building and only have my neighbors look at me so strangely. And man, worm compost is just great. There is so much research on the benefits of worm compost. And you know, you'll go to stores and you'll see they have slow release fertilizer for sale. So that when you put something down on the soil, it doesn't immediately wash away because of, you know, because this is another thing to understand. What holds minerals and other things in place in the soil is the soil food web. And if your soil doesn't have a strong, and when you put mineral or amendments down on the soil, unless the food web gobbles them up and latches onto them, they wash away. They wash deeper and deeper down into the subsoil where they're not available to plants, or they literally wash out into the groundwater table. And then we're polluting our water, which is what urban areas do every single spring. And these dumbass companies come along and they apply all of these synthetic fertilizers and stuff to people's lawns.
Right.
And studies show, you know, like half of what they're applying.
It goes right in the water.
Yeah. So we have a client for my son's worm casting business over in Lexington. We have actually two of them now. And every spring they get 20 gallons of worm castings from my son's worm casting operation that they apply to their lawn. And all of their neighbors are always amazed because their lawn looks good all year long when their neighbors' lawns look all dead, and because of the benefits of the worm castings, because they increase water retention and they strengthen the soil food web, and they're a slow release form of fertilizer. So they hold on to the nutrients and they promote healthy plant growth and they promote healthy root system, you know, better deep. So there's, you know, even over and above the benefits of standard compost, worm compost is just where it's at. And it's a super, super easy thing to do, to make your own worm compost. It's, you know, it's not rocket science.
Right. Okay. Let's get on to, produce, growing produce. But one of the things I'm interested in, hearing from you is just, how difficult is it to purchase seed at this time with the shortages the past year, especially if you're just gardening, you know, producing food for yourself right now?
Yeah. So Modern Farmer, I think back in December, started warning people about seed shortages for this year. You know, a lot of the major seed sellers, I haven't checked recently, but they're definitely struggling to keep up with orders. And there are all sorts of things that are very hard to come by, especially from some of the... So I wanted to get a little bit more seed potato this year to go along with what I had and what I saved. Called two of the main places I normally get seed potato from. They were sold out. They gave me the names of another place, this place up in Louisville. And this place said they got in 4 tractor trailer loads of seed potatoes. Mm-hmm. And they were already sold out and they could not get any more.
Wow.
There's still places you can get seeds, especially some smaller seed companies. What I'll do is remind me, I know a small business who actually it's a family business, kind of like our business, and they have a little seed business. They'd probably love to do a promo with Solari and give a discount to Solari subscribers for their seed business. And they still have seeds because they planned ahead because they're smart. And they're a great small business. And so we can get that to listeners and stuff who are interested. You know, but some of the bigger companies like Johnny's and Baker Creek and whatnot.
Right.
And I've heard in stores, you know, store-bought seeds are just so crummy at times. I don't like buying the Lowe's and Home Depot type, you know, seeds and plants if I can help it.
What about seed savings or seed banks? What can you tell the audience about those?
Well, seed saving, I don't know why more people don't save seeds. So, you know, since Solari people are silver people, this will probably resonate with them. But a lot of common plant seeds cost the same per ounce as silver.
Wow.
So let that sink in. When you're buying most of your garden plant seeds, you're paying the same price per ounce as silver. So seeds, you know, but it's a little packet. So, you know, it's $3 for a little packet. The little packet is like 0.02 ounces or something ridiculous, you know, for 25 seeds. You know, so seeds are expensive. Learning to seed save is totally worth it. But, you know, like, we can't really get into this deeply today, but one of the things I talk about in some of our on-farm classes and some of my talks is about a quarter of everything we grow now, we save seeds by letting the plants go to seed themselves. And then in the spring, they'll re-germinate and we just move them around. You know, so you can even seed save by making a small greenhouse or a low tunnel or other things and purposely letting plants go to seed and shaking the seeds over a bed so that they'll come back next year. And then you can just lift out the plants and repot them in different places.
Right. Yeah, your tomatoes are particularly good at that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, well, and no, obviously, you know, the problem is you can only do this if you're not growing a lot of different plants that are going to cross-pollinate.
Right.
The only tomato we grow are cherry tomatoes for my son's cherry tomato business. And so it works great for us because, you know, the cherry tomatoes and a lot of the flowers, they're only, you know, crossing within their own families. And you know, so it works. So obviously, like, you know, seed saving becomes more complicated. You know, like the only winter squash we grow is butternut. And we'll grow some pumpkins. And so that we don't have to worry about our butternut and our, you know, crop.